WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
I'm talking to you now on the radio, so all that you can use to interpret what I want to communicate is my words. Now think of what you may be missing. I can say, for instance, here's a record I think you'll enjoy. And while I am making this very pleasant, positive statement, I might also be rolling my eyes around or winking my eye at an engineer, two gestures that would actually indicate to anyone watching that I really didn't think you were going to like this record very much at all. The gestures I'm making in this case would alter the meaning of what I'm saying by indicating my sarcasm. Language is a very important part of communication, but it isn't everything. If you were here in the studio with me now, I think that I would be able to tell by watching your face if you were bored, moderately interested, or very interested in what I'm saying now. The study of how people communicate through body movement and through gestures is called kinesics. The founder of this branch of communication and anthropology is my guest, Dr. Ray Birdwhistle. He's written the two groundbreaking books on the subject, Introduction to Kinesics, which was published in 1951, and Kinesics in Context, published in 1971. Dr. Birdwhistle suggests that 65% to 70% of all human communication occurs through body motion, and he's even considered the possibility that words might function to enhance body language. Dr. Birdwhistle is presently a professor of communication at the Annenberg School of the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome to Fresh Air. It's really
Thank
a
you.
Great privilege to have you here.
Thank you. One correction.
Yeah.
The 65%. Actually, what I'm trying to say there is that at any given moment, the communication between human beings is a full package, that all of our senses are involved and they're all patterned, that since we have to be able to talk, to let one another know, and let very complicated kinds of messages, such as, I'm all right, you're all right, are you ill, is there danger, are you hungry, is there food in that direction, And we have to do it upwind and downwind. We have to be able to do it in the light. We have to be able to do it in the dark. We're 24-hour animals. We do it near the seashore. We do it in the mountains. We do it when we're hunting so that we can't be seen. We can't be heard. So that all of these mean that in order to be able to reach one another and to be continuously in contact, the moment that you accept the fact that communication is not just the matter of an on-and-off business that starts when you call on the telephone or say, hey, now hear this, and then you send a message and someone receives it, which the model is much more like in the telecommunicational model in which you're talking about doing it by mail or doing it by TV or doing it by radio or doing it by telephone. But that we have to remember that those are special technologically developed aspects in which is really a shorthand. So that when we talk to someone in the telephone, it's not that we're not moving and that they're not moving and that we're not acting in terms of their movement, because it's impossible to sit still. You'd have to almost be athletic. You also continue to exude odors, and you smell your own odors, you feel your own movements. That is, it isn't just that when you make a movement, it's not only that you see my movement, but that I feel my movement while I'm making it, which tells me that I'm making some sense.
Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Probably everyone knows that by watching someone's face, you learn something about what they're saying and about how they're reacting to you and what they're really thinking.
Again, a correction.
Okay.
Again, a correction.
The whole body.
Yes.
Okay.
Because remember that we invented faces with movies. That there weren't any faces around before movies. That there were a few people who were painters, who saw faces. But by and large, human beings didn't have talking faces. They had whole bodies. So that the assumption that it's loaded in the face is a convention that really came in with the movies and then was picked up by TV. So when we say, "Look me in the face," if you look someone in the face, it's very very seldom that you do that. You will do it when you're making love, or you do it when you're angry, But most of the time, you're picking it up. You're looking sideways. You're going on about your business. So the assumption of face-to-face is it's almost an over-the-coke dream of young adolescents, or of the doctor talking to the patient, or the lawyer trying to fix
But statements like the eyes or the window of the soul certainly precede movies and television.
Of course it does, and it's also nonsense. If you remember that if you look directly at someone's eyes, you do not see movement, because the center of your focal vision only picks up form. The lateral aspect, by looking in someone's eyes, you're able to see the movement of the remainder of the body by the lateral portions of the activity of the eye. But what we think we do, or what we think we see, really isn't terribly important when you begin to analyze it. Obviously, much of this isn't surprising. I can't imagine when Galileo came home and said to Mrs. Galileo, "Gee, I just found out that if you drop lead, it falls down." She'd say, "New? You know, what's new?" Well, the problem is that it's the question of the difference between what's a commonsensical model and what's necessary in the larger world.
Are you, through the study of kinesics, trying to find the equivalent of gravity for that theory, that force that makes everything that we already know exists possible?
Well, you see, in a sense, communication is a concept that has to be understood as you understand gravity. When I was a little boy, I remember that I thought that gravity was something that one body did sucked at the other one, that the big body had something inside it that sucked on the small body. And so I acted. Then as I got older and began to understand something about gravitational field, I began to understand that gravity was the relationship between two bodies in space. In that sense, communication is not the words I send to you or that you send to me. It's a statement of our relationship of two bodies in space. And you're quite correct. We are looking for that order of a piece of theory so that the original development of the body movement material, I was interested in because I'd been an athlete, because I was a dancer, and also had something called a kinesthetic synesthesia. You know that, did you ever watch someone watch a boxing match and they'd shift their shoulders in tune with the other, or that watch somebody jump and your leg would go up?
Yeah.
Well, that's a synesthesia. That means that you feel in your body that is instead of it, you're seeing it, you're feeling it in the very muscles. Well, as a child, I had very high amount of that. So it was very good for learning dancing and very good for a lot of things. But I became increasingly intrigued with the extent to which, particularly when I began to watch people speaking to the same person speaking more than one language and watch their body motion change. And then I realized that I had to deal with the fact that there was some tight relationship between these. Now, because I'm an American, because I'm an educated person, because my parents were educated and put a great emphasis on words and on learning words and on reading, and I still do, I always thought of words being central to the relationship. Until we began the studies and began to actually clock how much people were talking, and discovering that people seldom talk more than 5 minutes a day. And a few people as much as 2 hours. But the image that they have, particularly among us who are those of us who are professional vocalizers, is that there's a great deal amount of talk. Well, there isn't very much talk going on. But communication has to go on all the time in order to know how your world is operating. So that the moment you began to deal with it, and then the question becomes a different one. I'm terribly interested in when it's appropriate to talk. Now, this is an appropriate place to talk. There is no point in us sitting here gesturing or emitting odors or being warm or in balance over the radio. We have to use words. We use tones of voice. We use stylistic variations. But those are because that's a shorthand. And a shorthand in the same sense that if you take your hand across your throat telling me we're about to finish, that's also a shorthand. It's not that it simply it stands for something. It's a derivative out of a whole package.
If I went to France and started talking, most people would not understand what I was saying because I don't really speak their language.
No,
and
but if they knew you were a foreigner, you see, if the moment you began to remember, you're not communicating because you're communicating the fact you're a foreigner, and you're communicating the fact that they can't comprehend you. then that set of signals that you're sending then sets off a demand for something called a translator. Now, remember, that's very late in history that we invented a translator. At one time, the fact you were incomprehensible meant either that you were insane or that you were an enemy, and so you were killed.
But let me ask you, so right. I went to France, and I didn't say much, but someone walked into the room and they saw me grinning, or they walked into the room and they saw me weeping. I could probably assume that they knew what was up, that I was either very happy or very miserable at that moment. Is that universal?
Nope, they're not. Even within the United States, the amount of smiling, let's say, that you get, if you go south of the Mason-Dixon line, you'll get about 75% more smiling than you do the moment you come north of it. If you go up toward areas, you said that you went to school in Buffalo. Well, in Buffalo, you get almost no smiling at all. It's a very, very low smile area. And that Tubi dialect area, where they have hit Kip, and that series right across from Rochester to Hamtramck, right across the lake, is one of the low smiling areas of the world. It is the smile. In the south, the smile, and note our president, who upset a great number of people, not because of the amount he smiled, but because the situations in which he smiled seemed inappropriate to smiling. The Southerner very often uses smiles to say, I'm being polite, and to turn off wrath and to forestall anger. The Northerner tends to say, save smiling for your friends and if something is funny. You remember in Buffalo the number of times if you smiled wrong, people would say, what's funny?
Yeah, I guess that's true. But on the other hand, I remember walking around the university sometimes not smiling, and someone walking up to me and saying, what's wrong? And I'd get angry, and I'd say, nothing's wrong. I'm just not smiling. There's nothing in particular to be smiling at.
Maybe I'm asking some other things, too, though. You see, if it's a situation in which it is appropriate to smile, say two students passing on the walk will tend to smile at one another in a particularly adolescent, vacant way. If you ever notice, you can see them coming. And the two of them will be, hello, hi, and go right on. And later, about 5 minutes later, say, you know, I must just pass someone back there. That is, it isn't even a contact. It is merely a signal almost of the same nature as a dog wagging his tail, indicating I'm going to pass through your space. But the assumption that there's contact and the assumptions about a smile and what is a smile and when is it used. Smile, when you say that, may cover an insult. I'm sure you remember your mother saying, take that smile off your face.
I remember my mother also, like the person at the university, saying, why don't you smile more?
Yeah, be happy. Be happy. Be fat. Be healthy. The smile in that sense coming with that. But you see, the moment you begin to ask for the universal, see, remember that anything that's universal is meaningless. That is, if it totally overcomes, that is, any signal that does not adapt to the context in which it appears is not part of communication. It simply is not part of it. It has to be variable. You see, it is the essence. The thing that we say about all communicative elements, whether it's in language or body motion or odor or what have you, is that it has something called duality of patterning. A linguist by the name of Charles Hockett developed that concept. Now, what that means is that it not only is a distinct signal, but it's a signal that enters into a modification situation. That is, other things happening in the series will change it. That is, if I wink at you and smile, it is different than a condition if I make a face at you and smile at the same time. The weeping of happiness, the weeping of tearfulness, the weeping, for instance, of the Persians, that comes very easy. Our distinction between weeping for males and weeping for females, the concept of when is it appropriate to weep. The whole business, if you watch many of the less sophisticated young women who are involved in learning women's lib, will say girls should not weep. Why should they not weep? I mean, why should men be told they have to weep or not weep? I'm not talking about it being good or bad. I'm talking about the variability that's built in, but that in the shorthand, let's say, of the theater, you can say, now you weep because this is sad. Now you smile and project it or weep louder. These again, are shorthands. They're fiction. They're stylistic fictions that are useful. But unless they're modifiable, the weep of happiness, the weep of delight, the weeping of, if you sit in a movie, the sheer joy of sitting there weeping over a puppy dog is not about grief. So but what we'd like to do, what's happened is that many of the popular charlatans of body motion act as though there are specific movements that have specific meanings and that they are universal. And part of this, of course, is the new biologism, that is the, which is again the old reactionary position that is in which we make social change, put it in the genes where it's out of reach.
Well, since you brought up the question of men not crying or women not crying, let's talk a little bit about some of the gestural differences and body differences that you found in studying the way men and women use body language to communicate. I know you've done this in different contexts and different societies and cultures. Everybody always asks themselves how much of the difference between men and women when we see a difference is biological, is inherited, and how much of it comes from the environment we were brought up in and the expectations our parents had for us.
I think the question how much is probably non-answerable. I think that if we put it in those kind of quantitative terms, I would say this, that if you start with the fact that as a species, we are either, if you were to take, say, 300 species, and at one end you would have a species in which the male and female are indistinguishable. They can't even tell one another apart. Geese, for instance, are an example. The geese constantly are getting confused as to whether that's another girl or a boy goose. At the other extreme are animals in which the differences are so great that just for moments in an entire lifetime do they discover that they are they capable of mating even. And only by microscopic examination could you possibly tell. Now, out of that 300 species, man is somewhere about halfway in between. He's weakly dimorphic, and he's also weakly homomorphic. That is, so we're not dealing with a species that's very greatly different. If you start with that, then you take the fact that in every culture we make a variation in the times in which males and females are supposed to be different. That is, in some cultures, we start right out in our culture, for instance, putting them into blue booties and pink booties. But we don't pay much attention to it after, and when they get older, we may worry a bit about it, but by and large, we have periods in which we care a lot. Say, we act as though our kids are pretty safe, so between, say, 8 and 10 or 11, we don't really worry if the boy is, quotes, a little sissy and the girl is a little tomboy. We sort of mused about it. But immediately thereafter, we become terribly frantic if there isn't great difference. Other cultures may not do that. Margaret Mead and I worked a great deal on this with a lot of movies. We'd find groups that until puberty there was no interest. We found others in which the moment they'd had the babies there was no real interest in the difference. Now, what are we talking about in the range of difference? There's also class differences. A southern upper middle class southern girl is going to be much more, quotes, feminine than a northern girl. That is, she's going to accentuate certain kinds of movements, and inner speech too. That is, but we're not talking about biological differences here. We're talking about when are the conditions of sending signals about gender and about same gender and opposite gender. So that we're talking about something very different. That is, even the secondary sexual characteristics. If you take a large enough population of humans, you don't get two bell curves, one male and one female. You get two overlapping curves, in which, starting right from the bony structure, the mastoid process, and bony structure of the head, and the size of the jaw, and the size of the shoulders, the way the hips are built, you tend to get a high range of overlap within from primary sexual characteristics, primary meaning fertile sperm producers and fertile ovum producers. Now, the moment you know that, the moment you quit acting as though there were two sexes, and there are probably in any given culture anywhere from 8 to 20 genders. That is, old woman, young woman, adolescent woman, ready woman, old male, young male, dirty old male, young punk, little baby, boy baby, tough little baby. All of these are gender differences. They describe certain sets and certain reinforcements. The culture and the membership of the culture, and particularly those people who make their living on such matters, that is, who live on the simplicities of unisex or of this is very feminine or this is very masculine, all of these things will tend to emphasize it in different ways. Actually, gender happens to be a very good way in our society, and has been in all societies, in all human societies, to load certain specialized roles, certain specialized knowledges, so that there is a real division of labor, so that you're not actually dealing with some kind of pure white lard of homogeneity. Now, you can reduce the importance of these, and you can say there are conditions under which you will emphasize this. That is, as my mother used to say, there's a time and a place for everything. She used to say it's not that an upper status girl should not be sexual. It's just that she should not be obvious. That is, she's, and if you come from a culture in which someone else does your advertising, you're in a very different position than you come from a part of the society in which you've got to go out, and you have to sell yourself as a member. You know, if you go to the present single bar, and watch the sheer turn up of the volume of I am this gender of this age, you know something about what's happened in a society which has lost its marriage brokers and has lost its people who arrange so that we're leaving a terribly serious and terribly difficult matter, which is choosing a mate to the given individual. Very few societies are ever stupid enough to do that.
I mean, these things were planned by their parents.
Well, because it is a... See, sexual contact isn't of very much importance, but having a mate and organizing child rearing and organizing the inheritance of property is not an individual matter, except for people who aren't terribly important. That is, we've always allowed that to the people at the bottom of society. It's only that we've now had it creep up into the middle class that it's gotten so treacherous and dangerous.
Well, let me just go back a couple of steps and get back to...
But we're dealing with body motion here. Mm-hmm. Because we're talking about the conditions under which it becomes very evident. That is, you know the people who you're going to see, who are going to emphasize, they're going to have 1 inch more of heel, they're going to have one more tie in the uplift, they're going to have 1 bit more of makeup, they're going to have 1 ounce more of odor. Male, female, whatever. But you're dealing with a condition in which gender is controlled by the socioeconomic position of those individuals. The particular language they speak is a matter of the particular culture. Yes.
If it wasn't for fashions, it wasn't for everybody's parents having some notion about what a girl is and what a boy is, do you think that men and women would mostly walk similarly, run similarly, sit with their legs crossed the same way? Do you think that there would be less of a noticeable difference to the casual observer who is male and who is female, aside from, you know, breasts, you know, with
well,
assuming the person was wearing
clothes,
necessary, right?
Not necessarily even looked at. I don't know, because it's a big if. You're talking about a rather special species in humans. Remember that we're a very strange species in that we are probably one of the very few species in the world that can suspend courtship and go directly to copulation. Nearly every other animal species has large amounts of courtship for the selection of mates. They don't do it on the basis of exciting the other. They do it on the basis of picking an appropriate mate. Now, we're a very strange species. We're also a very strange species in the fact that with the vast differences across the world, we are still every normal human being is able to make every other normal human being of the opposite sex pregnant, or to be an impregnator, or which is not true of most species. Very quickly do you get speciation in animals, so that you get so that they become sterile to one another. In humans, we have very, very, very easy flow of genes. Now, with that easy flow and that easy access to one another, it means that sex is terribly easy. It's, for humans, is much easier than what we call, isn't that like an animal, is really very much more like a human. So that sex being so easy to humans, and being such an easily, we turn it around and act as though it's difficult. So that we have this tremendous emphasis it's very much as though we were selling the achievement of falling on your rear end. It is not a difficult matter to go backward. It is not a the difficult matter in every culture is how to keep people from having sex, if they were in any way appropriate. So that the answer to your question is very difficult when you say, if there wasn't this emphasis, what would you have? If there wasn't that emphasis, we didn't have to store the division of labor. They would be storing it someplace else. I suspect that man would be able to screw that up just as easily as he does this one.
I'd be interested in hearing what you think of transsexuals, because there are a number of people in the society mm-hmm. who have decided that, for men, that they were basically trapped in a man's body and yeah. really felt like a woman and would prefer to be a woman, yeah. and given that there is an operation, might take that option and transform their body to be more congruent with their mental view.
There's nothing new about it. A number of societies have done it. It's just that it's become a good deal more literalized and medicalized. Transvestitism is a very deep and very respected thing in West Africa. It's been in many, many cultures. And it's no different than the fact that we decide to change our age, that we want to be older, we want to be younger. We may think some people are a little silly because they're trying to act like an 18-year-old when they're 80. But age is another place we store capacities, we store the division of labor. So that I don't think I find anything very exciting, but I think that the institutionalization of it in a society which gets its religion very often preoccupied with the genital area and builds around deprivation of sex or of its the supervision of sex and loads it in its morality system, which is something that Western European society has done. Very, very few societies have gotten that involved in. Society like that, then it becomes a difficult matter because what you're doing is not no longer a private matter, you're asking it to be institutionalized. I think it's a perfectly fair institutionalization, but it's not going to be easy any more than if I ask the right to be 18 years old. I'm 61. I have a beautiful right to be 61. I can even play 70 once in a while. But if I try playing 40, I'm going to get into trouble. Now, not very serious trouble, because it will depend on how people want to feel. I can even pretend for a little while that I'm a different social class, but I'm not going to be able to get away with that. The moment you began to say, how do we change our roles, what orders of legitimization, you began to deal with the fact that society, many parts of society, particularly people who get angry about it, people who are anxious about it, people who are uncertain about their own identity, and people who make a livelihood of this being their issue. I mean, it could be their livelihood in a philosophical sense or a spiritual sense or in an economic sense. Then it's going to be difficult. Of course, I don't have any. It's a little like saying, what do you think about people having their teeth fixed? Or how do I feel about having a nose fixed? Or circumcision versus a non-circumcision? Or a pedicure? I think that each of these things are probably more dramatic than important. Except that they are important in terms of minimal variations on a theme. I think the business of having one's gender changed is probably reasonably less important than the decision to, let's say, get married.
Ray Birdwhistle, everybody always talks about how television and mass media has changed dialect and changed language.
Nonsense.
You don't think it has?
No.
Well, what has it done to body language?
Actually, not very much. I can tell you a couple of things. And I can recall when radio was coming in and the decision was made that that radio was going to speak Middle Western English. You may remember that. The bright boys around the country said, we're going to ruin the variations in the country. We're going to have less dialectal differences. We're all going to be speaking Middle Western. It's not true. Probably we speak more variation than we ever did. Dialects are at least as deep, if not deeper. Now, part of this is because of the extent to which dialect is not merely is not a matter of birth, but is a matter of development, a matter of learning, and it is a method of saying, I am who I am, this is what my past is. It's a way of including a vast amount of knowledge so that your listener will know something about you. Well, the same is true of body motion. It's very, very hard. It's very hard. You learn certain things. I can recall, for instance, that when I was a young man, my Krill cousins were taught never to cross their legs, that only secretaries crossed their legs, that they would cross their ankles. They walked around with a book on their head, and because they were supposed to have their back straight. They learned how to carry their breasts and how not to have them too high, because if they had them too high, then they would be regarded as obvious, so that they sat around and practiced from about 12 or 13 to 15 or 16 on how to hold this added avoirdupois. In general, you take your models, whether you're modeling yourself after an upper-class Englishman or modeling and learning, but this hasn't been that much change. By and large, our theatrical people are largely up out of the working class. They're one generation out of the working class. Most of their movements tend to be the way working class believe the people that they're imitating look like. That is, we can go back and watch this being taught, so that you've got what was regarded as a status movement in the movies versus what was regarded as a Bowery movement. It all came out of New York City and out of given areas of where they could get their actors. There were a few differences. One of the funniest was the business of, if you take, let's say, the way in which standard Americans stand, males, they tend to stand with their at rest with their feet about 6 inches apart, 6 to 8 inches apart. The people who were in the new movie industry were largely Russian Jews. They come from a culture in which the feet were held very close together. And when they came over, one of the things that they noticed was so-called cowboys. Now, when I was a youngster, cowboys walked with bowed legs and their feet together. Then they began to see this business, they began to notice the cowboys, and so that increasingly the cowboy began to be someone who walked with his legs way apart, so that he stalked down the street in the gun smoke position with the two guns and the legs spread apart, almost that waddle down the street. Well, actually, what that is Western with a Jewish accent. He learned that this is an adaptation. They never walked that way in the old days. That's one of the few things. Now, of course, girls go through vaping periods, and you've got the present very pukey lower mouth look, the so-called the male sulky look, in which the mouth looks a little whiny and slightly
pouting,
unweaned, actually, and this is supposed to be somehow sexual. Well, we went through a period, I remember, when girls had to have mouths like rosebuds, but these are fads. Generally speaking, they are most largely loved by 10, 11, 12, 13, 14-year-olds, right in a transitional period.
It seems that news programs now pay great attention to the way their anchor people look. There's a way
it's
of being very
awful.
Intense on the news, staring right into the camera, like alarms are going off all over you, but you're going to read this news and you get it done quickly. What is that saying to us about...
I think part of the thing is...
TV or about audience
Part of it is
news?
A detachment from the stuff that they're saying. And they are so involved. It's obvious that they're so involved with the producer, with the fear of loss of job, and with ever good reason, with the turnover in the industry and the amount of money that's in it, so that you get a tremendous amount of anxious behavior. Which goes with, for instance, the stilted talk, so that you get the inversion, for instance, of certain emphasis. A pattern, so that you get a pattern, say where one would say rocking chair, they would say a rocking chair. the separation. It's actually an illiterate English that's being spoken. This is pretty recent. I suspect that it will go over very, will not last very long, because they're having a good deal of difficulty holding audiences. And I think one of the reasons they're having it is because they are being so badly coached in the major markets. Now, you can see in some of the minor markets, there are people who are actually able to talk about the weather. And you can hear an intelligent person who knows something about the weather talking to an intelligent person. You get the people who talk, who will tell you that there has been a fire, and you have a sense that they're going to change slightly in their movements when they begin to talk about someone having a baby. That there's a fire in which 14 people die, and then there's a baby that gets that a new baby is born, and it's a wonderful thing, and you get it done with the same emotions, the same, so that this separation of the text from the ego display, I think, will not last too long. It's destructive, and I'm terribly sad about it, because I think the news is too important to be wasted on professionals right now, when professionals are doing such a bad job. I'm not saying I could do better.
Because you have spent so much time studying body motion and body communication, I would imagine that some people would feel very much like you are analyzing them when you see them. If I said to you, what have you learned about me through watching me in the past 40 minutes that we've been speaking, would you tell me to go get lost, or would you tell me what...
No, I'd say you couldn't afford my opinion. This is hard work. That the amount of time it would take when I do a baseline, for instance, if we are studying a transcript for a discourse and going to look at, say, 20 seconds of an interactional sequence, it takes me up to 2 weeks to find out what the person does under the circumstance so that I can begin to measure that point. I can no more do it, except that I would do it as a human being. That is, as a person, I respond to you as a perfectly charming, personable person who's being very supportive and taking care of me and doing your job.
That's a relief, yeah.
Yeah, sure. And that you're not making me uncomfortable. But that's the standard decent message, and that's what one does. Do I want to know any more? After 45 years, one of the things that I am relatively certain of, there are very few people who are very interesting.
Well, let's face it, one of the things that people really want now, and we could see this just by reading the lists of bestsellers, people want power, and people want people to treat them like they have power. Mm-hmm. And I think that some of body language has been distilled down to, how can I arrange my desk, how can I arrange my body, how can I carry myself, how can I sit,
sure,
so that I really look important,
right,
so that I look like I have power, and so that I can manipulate people and get them to do what I want
them to
do.
Let me tell you two things. One, when I was a little boy, there used to be an ad in the paper that every little boy I knew bought. And this was a thing that if you sent them a dollar, they would send you a little machine that you could look through girls' dresses with. I think there's a lot of the people who are buying them because it's like that little machine that, quote, you could see through girls' dresses with. At the other end, there are the people, you know, one of the things, we have a very big industry today called marriage counseling. Now, one of the jobs of a marriage counselor is to help people have a good divorce. And one of their jobs is that they are there for people to say that they've tried everything. So that they've gone to the preacher, they've gone to their mother-in-law, and they've talked to a friend, and then they go to the marriage counselor, and having done that, they have done everything that's possible to do, therefore they can have a decent divorce. Well, I'm all for that, and I support marriage counseling that way. For those kind of people, on the bottle of Hadacol, do you ever notice that years ago there was there's a patent medicine, a Geritol, one of them, that on the back it says this elixir contains those minerals and vitamins necessary for those people who need them. Well, I think that the orders of people who are willing to pay to have someone reassure them that their room is perfect that their hair is shaped the right way, that they are wearing the shoes which will not embarrass them if they happen to be caught dead in New York. This bra will get you by in San Francisco. That for those people who need to spend that money to convince themselves, I am totally delighted that we have developed a specialist to make them happy. Now, I think these people usually have a reasonably short half-life because of the extent to which these fads shift and change. We've gone through in the last 10 years the smellies, the feelies, the tasties, the sit-down and talk-it-outs. These orders of fads, I think, are probably pretty necessary at times when our other institutions are in pretty tremendous trouble and a high number of highly mobile people are left without sufficient lateral ties and supports in the society. Therefore, you do get the preoccupation. I don't wish to sound antagonistic toward it. I feel, in a sense, that the relationship of all of these people who say, I will tell you how you hold your hands and I'll tell you what your soul is like or whether you should get married or whether the girl really likes you. It's an industry of the same shape as astrology. Astrology is in the paper, the most highly read part of the total newspaper. It's the one thing you cannot leave out except the funny page. I do not think this should affect the amount of money given to the National Science Foundation.
On the other hand, I would guess that a lot of people in high executive positions have consulted your work and have consulted specifically your research about furniture arrangement, position between people,
yeah,
to find out what a person in power does to look like they have power and have gone about arranging their offices so that they look like they have power and positioning themselves a certain number of inches,
yes,
away from someone so that they are inside the person's personal range and can be more effective in their discussion,
yes,
with them. How do you feel about that? It's out of your control who uses your research.
Oh, no. When they call me, and they do call me, and I say, well, I you can't afford me. And they say, oh, yeah, well, I give you X amount. And I say, no, you can't afford me because that you would have to buy me because that's not what I do. And I can tell you where to go. There's some people who do it, but remember that the real point in this is to make the person feel better. That the reason you get you buy a new hat, even though you say you want to, the woman who buys a hat to please her husband, is rationalized. She's buying a hat to please her. The person who does it over their office in order to feel powerful is someone who, by changing their office, will feel powerful. I recall Gregory Bateson, a very good friend of mine, telling about a schizophrenic patient of his who on Mother's Day sent his mother a card. She was very angry because it said, I'm thinking of you today because you've been just like a mother to me. Well, in a sense, this is the people who buy a particular kind of desk so that they can feel powerful. That if that buying that desk makes them feel powerful, it's a little like Mr. Ford's win button. That if you can put it on and win with it, well, I'm all for it. The problem is that we're putting apples and oranges and peanuts together when we're thinking about these things. It is perfectly true that if you become aware of the fact that the way in which you behave affects other people, and that you are affected by the way other people behave, and that you are not ever, unless you're insane, an island into yourself, and that other people do bother you. You can't pretend sticks and stones may break my bones with words or the way you behave. The student who comes in and puts his feet on the edge of my desk, I say, I've gotten your message. You fail. That is why our relationship is not that kind of relationship. By your putting your feet on my desk does not make you the teacher. The student who calls me by my first name is a person who gets a treatment. He's out of my class.
Okay, this thing is from the other end. The other approach that
right.
is used in this
right.
is that, listen, you are putting out all these signals. You are unaware that you're putting them out. Let me help you make you aware of it. You are wearing clothes that are sloppy, that say, I am a sloppy person.
Right.
You are your desk is arranged in the room in a certain way that says to people, I don't want to speak to you. I'm afraid to speak to you. Let me come in and help you fix your clothes and arrange your desk so that you're giving out a more positive message. How'd you react to that?
Oh, I have no trouble with that because I don't want to do it. You see, I happen to think that by and large, most of the behavior of people is what they really are. The paranoid who says people think I'm a son of a bitch are probably correct. They do. You know, a great number of the people who send signals that they're slobs, they send signals because they are slobs. But if you say, how do you get over it, the moment you want to get over it, then you're already part of something different. Then you go to someone who can help you. It's the problem with the therapist. That is, the person who... There are many people who come to a therapist to prove they come to a therapist. There are people who come and say, I want to have I want you to help me change the way I talk. Perfectly easy and a good speech therapist if they have someone who can afford to have their speech change. But if they get their speech changed and they no longer can walk into the local bar, and if they get their speech changed and their parents feel like they no longer hold the values of this small community, they have to know that other things go with it. So that these tiny little one-bit deals, these one-shot changes, I'll give you a tie that'll make you important. I'll give you a hairdo. By and large, all this ends up with is a disappointed person who's only had one thing to them they've tried. Now, if you can, on the larger hand, give them a larger picture, that is that everything they do is important and that they have no way of being trivial, that a human individual has an incapacity to be impotent. He is important. And that importance is there. Now, once you know that, then you say, what is it I'm trying to learn how to be? Then you can do something different. But the one-shot deal is generally you get what you pay for.
We are seeing some body language engineering within the legal system at this point.
Oh, certainly.
I've heard about defendants who are on trial having consultants come in and also, again, telling them what to wear and... videotaping them and watching the videotapes with the defendant so that the defendant can see when he or she is putting out cues to the jury, mm-hmm. cues that would indicate that they're guilty, cues that they would indicate that something that's being said on the stand is making them uncomfortable, cues that might indicate that they are basically dishonest people. And they work with them much, I guess, as you would with an actor, to reshape those facial expressions, to adjust the posture a little bit, and again, to change the wardrobe. If a person is innocent, they will obviously want to do everything to work in their favor.
That was the same theory that was used in New England when they used the ducking bench, that if they were innocent, they didn't drown. Let me say it another way. Of course, we've always insisted that people have clothes appropriate to the situation they're going into. That the business of not listening to a country lawyer always knew this. This isn't anything new about it. We're developing, though, a very good friend of mine is now on the Michigan Supreme Court. And Michigan Change called me before the Supreme Court to see about a change in the legal system. In terms of the submission of body behavior as evidence and facial expression instead of just recording the words. And I opposed it.
How come?
And I opposed it on the basis that the amount of time it would take to learn what was being done and to record it would be so expensive and so destructive, and we knew so little at the moment, that you would end up with a model largely of a lower middle class psychologist who's willing to make a great deal of money going around and selling their services to courtroom attorneys. I've often lectured since that time because I had to do the same thing in Hawaii. They were going to change it, and they did not after that. I urge them to use the jury system because the jury is still the best device we have because it is a cross. Right. I think that any lawyer knows that the way his client dresses is going to make a great deal of impact. The way he talks, the amount they talk, whether they project. There's never been any doubt that there's a difference. A jury of males will pay attention to a pretty girl differently than they and to an older woman than they will to, and you have a very heavy woman, and so on. This is folk knowledge, and every human being has to have it. If you're crazy, if you're really nuts, then you don't know that. And it's one of the jobs that a psychiatrist has very often, is teaching people that the way their clothes are makes a difference, or that they have no right. I can recall in the early 60s people saying, why do the flower people make other people so angry when they walk up and say, I love you? And the answer was that they had not yet established the relationship in which they could exchange that message. That I really, and that you do not admire having a person to be open with you if it's inappropriate for them to be open. That the conditions we're dealing with here is a piece of, I think that it's fraudulent, but I think it's relatively harmless. I think that the people who are doing it don't know what they're doing, but I don't think it hurts very much, and I think that they're taking... Irving Goffman does very good work on confidence men and marks. There are a lot of some of them are innocent confidence people. But if there is a confidence game, it's a little like saying I can give you a test, a Rorschach or a TAT or this test or that test, and tell you how you're going to act in a given situation. We do not have that control over given individuals. We can do something about a population.
Okay, so and that kind of approach would certainly eliminate recognition of ambiguity within gestures, and that a gesture might have subtlety or ambiguity to it.
It has to have.
Let me ask you this. I could say that if I learned many more words than I know now, I would have a much greater ability to communicate because I could communicate more subtly. I could communicate through my use of metaphor with greater detailed words, more subtlety, more texture, more gradation of what I was feeling. You wouldn't even agree with that.
No, I wouldn't agree with that because I remember my great uncle saying that no matter how good you get at making a caress, if the woman's got on a thick enough corset, you're not going to reach him. Well, the same thing is true I remember that when I was a child, my mother really believed that if you said ain't or had any dirty words, that was because you didn't have a good vocabulary. The size of the vocabulary is not what's important. What's important is the appropriateness of the vocabulary. That is, when we talk about good communication, we're not talking about the amount of communication. We're talking about how appropriate it is to the relationship. One of the great frauds of America is the selling the assumption that husbands and wives should be able to talk to one another all the time. Well, by and large, there comes a point, if they continue to talk more and more, they're going to get a divorce. Just almost automatic.
Why do you say that?
Well, partly because it's become inappropriate. That is, they're dealing with something which is appropriate for a psychiatrist and a patient, and they're telling stories and they're demanding the order of attention and putting the emphasis upon words, when other means of communication would be much, much more successful, like feeding, like letting alone, like trusting, like going away, like sleeping quietly. But remember that it's not necessarily bad communication because you get a divorce. It may be perfectly appropriate that these two people separate before they hurt one another too badly. But the assumption that more and more talk, that is the adolescent dream, I'm going to find somewhere somebody that we will walk off into the sunset talking, 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 is an adolescent dream. That is, the business, the communication is based on appropriateness and on growth.
To apply what you've just said to body language, if I were to sit in front of a mirror and be able to master the subtlety in which I move my eyebrow, or to be able to master smiling more frequently, or sitting with better posture than I usually do, you don't think it would make me a more communicative person?
Well, there's a great story about the woman who came back from an acting class and decided to let her husband know how much she loved her. And he said, my God, are you doing a hula? That is... The conditions of these orders of wriggling and posturing and face-making are nothing. It's rather like saying a poem to someone at a time when you should be saying hi. again, it's a matter of gaining confidence in the social situation. And body motion is obviously part of it. Odor is part of it. The words you use, the tone of voice you use. But the magic that's saying there is a magical word or a magical movement or a magical potion is, you know, it makes sense in a society in which people are taking pills to get magical sex or magical dreams or magical beauty.
I think I'm going to, if you don't mind, bring us more or less back to the point where we started from and ask you, if I can't read your book and find out how to communicate better with people.
No, you cannot.
Then why should we study kinesics?
Because I can't tell you why you should study kinesics, because it's not clear that anyone should. I think that communication should be studied, but it should be studied as part of ongoing growth of membership. So perhaps we can learn something about teaching as well as about learning, about giving, even learn something about receiving. That the more we know about the complete dependency the human beings have on other human beings, the less likely we are to become imitation telephones or imitation radios, when what we really want is a good, loving, warm, noisy, or quiet body to be close to.
Dr. Ray Birdwhistle, it's been a great pleasure to have you here. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Dr. Ray Birdwhistle. He is the pioneer of a whole body of communication and anthropology, which is called kinesics, which is basically the study of body language, of how people communicate using gestures, using body movements. He's currently a professor of communication at the Annenberg School of the University of Pennsylvania. His two groundbreaking books in this field are Introduction to Kinesics and Kinesics in Context.